Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, does Michigan's recall process stifle citizen voices? The organizer of a recall drive against a Traverse City state representative says, yes, it does.
It shouldn't be so hard to recall someone who has done a lot of bad things.
Michigan winemakers hoping to move the image of their wines beyond sweet and sweeter.
You know, the Midwest is a region that's still exploring and finding wine, and especially finding wine in their own backyard.
You're zooming along, you spot a state police car and instantly slow down. Well, we are not fooling those troopers.
I have a large blue Tahoe. If you see my car, please don't drive 7 to 10 miles under the speed limit. I'm running late as it is. I have places to go.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, Michigan winemakers trying to shake off that old too sweet image.
The issue here in the Midwest is that we still have a relatively sweet palate. There's still an awful lot of people that enjoy sweeter wines, and often that's because it's their first venture into wine.
We've got 5 wine regions, 1 in the UP and 4 in the Lower Peninsula. So there's always something nearby to go check out and taste to see if there's something that will please your palate.
But first, next week brings the start of the trial of State Representative Larry Inman. The Republican from the Traverse City area faces 3 federal charges of bribery, extortion, and lying to the FBI. He's accused of trying to trade his vote for campaign contributions. Those indictments triggered a grassroots recall effort, which successfully got enough signatures to force a recall election, but it was a heavy lift. Caitlin Flynn is with us now. She managed the recall effort. Caitlin, what was the argument you made to get people to sign the recall petition?
Talking with folks, it wasn't hard to get them to sign. I mean, you know, he was indicted, like you said, for extortion, bribery, and lying to the FBI, and he missed over 100 votes to the legislature. And that's exactly what we said to people. And so most people, when they walked up to us, once we said, I'm with the Inman recall campaign, they were excited to sign. They took the pen out of our hands. But for folks who didn't know about it, that's all we said was, you know, he was indicted. He missed votes. We deserve representation. We deserve better. So will you sign the recall petition?
How many volunteers were out there on the streets getting signatures?
Over 150.
So how many signatures did you need to gather?
The minimum is 12,201 valid signatures.
And how many did you ultimately get?
Just under 14,000.
All right, so you topped the minimum. And there was once a time when citizens had 90 days to gather those petition signatures. But you know, a quick history lesson, the recall law for legislators was changed during lame duck in late 2012. And reminder, that was a heck of a season. Right to work was jammed through. And then the Republicans pushed through major changes in the procedures for recalling elected officials. That 90-day window, that was shortened to 60 days. So, Caitlin, what did that shortened window of 60 days mean in your recall effort?
It made it a significant challenge. We had folks who were going out every single day for, you know, the last month or so to make sure that we hit our goals. And it wasn't only the 60-day window that made it a challenge. There's also a rule that they passed in that lame duck session in 2012 that you have to wait 6 months after the term is started of the state representative to start the recall process. So he was indicted in May, and we weren't able to start until July. And so what that did is that we had to start it all in July, you know, submitting the language for the petition, getting that approved. And then we had to wait another 40 days after Inman appealed our language. So we weren't able to start collecting petition signatures until September 23rd, which pushed us into really bad weather. We had to go through snowstorms, you know, really, really difficult situations. And if we had been able to start in May, in June, it would have made the entire process a lot easier on our crew.
How did this effort compare to other campaigns you've done?
That's a good question. You know, I've worked on a lot of campaigns, and I would say this was the most challenging. The issue was something that everyone agreed upon. You know, he missed work and he was indicted. Those are bad. Right? We didn't have to convince people of that. But just the hoops that we had to jump through made it a difficult campaign.
Caitlin, do you know how many other recall efforts have succeeded since the law was changed in late 2012?
We are the first. We are the first campaign to have gotten this far since 2012. You know, when we dropped off the signatures to the State Board of Canvassers, they told us these are the first recall signatures we've seen since the laws were changed in 2012.
Caitlin, now that you've been through this process, what do you see as the legislature's purpose in changing the law or in 2012? Or what was the result of that change?
I believe that their purpose was to make it harder to recall our elected officials, and they certainly succeeded. They made it difficult for folks to hold their legislators accountable. You know, saying that we have to wait 6 months of their term, that's it. That's a year period where we are able to go through this process, you know, and it also has to only be for what they did during, like, in that term. So using our recall for an example, you know, we can recall him for, you know, being indicted and for missing work, but we cannot recall him, you know, for, you know, sending those text messages because it happened during his previous term.
So it certainly constricted things for you. What would you want to say
Absolutely.
To today's lawmakers, to the legislature today, as we're talking in 2019? What do you want to say to them about this recall law?
I would say that this law makes it difficult for voters to have a voice, and that the laws need to change because our elected officials need to be held accountable for their actions. You know, it shouldn't be so hard to recall someone who has done a lot of bad things. You know, at the bare minimum, not showing up to work at the State House for 3 months, missing over 100 votes, that's what we elected Representative Larry Inman to represent us, to be voting on the House floor, to be in committees, to, you know, caucus with his peers. And he, you know, he didn't vote for 3 months, and he wasn't able to be in his caucus, or he was kicked out of his caucus. He doesn't have constituent services anymore, no staff, no office. It shouldn't be so hard to have representation.
Caitlin, at the bare minimum, what changes do you think need to be made in this law?
I think that the window should, you know, at least go back to 90 days. And I think that we should be able to recall them, you know, regardless of how far into their term they are.
And as for Representative Larry Inman, he has to make a decision early next week. Tell us about that.
Yes. So he has to decide by Monday if he would like to remain on the ballot for this recall election.
So he has to decide what, to opt out, or he is automatically the Republican nominee?
That's exactly right. If he chooses, he is automatically the Republican nominee. This triggers a normal, you know, a normal general election to decide who will be filling this seat. And so Monday is the day that he has to decide, you know, does he want to stay on the ballot and stay our representative, or is he going to opt out and let a different Republican take his place on the ballot?
Caitlin Flynn managed the recall campaign against State Representative Larry Inman successfully, turning in somewhere around 14,000 signatures in 60 days. Caitlin, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy. I was glad to be here.
A few weeks ago, we told you how cherry farmers in Michigan are suffering from the fallout of that international trade war. While they wait to see where the political cards fall, many farmers are bearing down for the winter. Here's Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston with an update.
After an early snowstorm in mid-November, Tom Coronado is staying warm in a tractor. He works for Cherry Key, a farming operation in Kuwaiten. In between some tart cherry trees, a worker holds a 10 to 12 foot fence post in place. Then Coronado, in his tractor, plants what looks like a stamp down on top. The tractor shoves the post into the ground, loudly rattling along the way. Coronado plants about a dozen of these posts next to a line of young tart cherry trees. He does this work every year, along with other winter upkeep, like pruning. When this fence is done, it will hopefully protect the young trees from deer.
If we don't do it, we battle the deer, so they'll prune the trees for us in a way we don't like.
And every cherry that farmers can keep this winter matters, especially now. the industry is not doing well. Michigan farmers have been getting priced out of the fruit market by cheap foreign competitors for years. Since 2006, the state has lost 160 tart cherry farms. And across the country, production is already down 18% from last year. That's all from the USDA. The industry recently got help via tariffs on Turkish cherry exporters, who were their biggest competitor. That has to have helped, right?
But how are things just broadly in northern Michigan cherries right now?
Well, they haven't changed a whole lot.
That's Nels Veliket, the head of Cherry Key and a member of the Dried Tart Cherry Trade Committee. He says importers have leftover cherries from Turkey. They're still selling those off instead of buying domestic ones.
So it's hard to know how long it will take for that inventory to work its way through the system before they begin buying domestic source cherries.
Veliket and other farmers told all of this to U.S. Senator Gary Peters at a meeting in Traverse City a few weeks ago. He said he'll take it back to Washington.
For them to understand, this is not just about cherry growers in Traverse City. It's about other small manufacturers and small industries across the country.
Earlier this year, Peters introduced a bill to make the U.S. Commerce Department investigate trade issues on behalf of small industries like cherries. That bill is stuck in committee. In fact, the whole Michigan cherry industry is kind of stuck in what Veliket describes as a holding pattern. One thing they've been waiting on are federal subsidies for lost profits from the trade war with China. The USDA is giving relief funds to farmers affected by that. But tart cherry farmers aren't on the list. Daniel Sumner is with the Agricultural Issues Center at the University of California, Davis. He says that subsidy program is super broad and doesn't get to a lot of farmers that may need it.
They're not painting with a brush, they're painting with a roller. You don't get the Mona Lisa done that way.
On top of that, Sumner says those subsidies are set to expire in November of 2020. And he says he's not sure if anyone will care about farmers after the election. In the meantime, Michigan farmers are tending to their cherry trees. The hope is they'll survive the winter and they'll have a strong harvest next year. For Points North, I'm Max Johnston.
That story was featured on Points North, a weekly show and podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. You can find more episodes at pointsnorthradio.org. Coming up, more than 1.7 million Michiganders are expected to hit the road for the Thanksgiving holiday. We'll check in with a Michigan State Police trooper about the Michigan left and more do's and don'ts of the road. Stay with us. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, Michigan winemakers trying to shake off that old too-sweet image.
The issue here in the Midwest is that we still have a relatively sweet palate. There's still an awful lot of people that enjoy sweeter wines, and often that's because it's their first venture into wine.
We've got five wine regions, one in the UP and four in the Lower Peninsula, so there's always something nearby to go check out and taste to see if there's something that will please your palate.
But first, next week brings the start of the trial of State Representative Larry Inman. The Republican from the Traverse City area faces three federal charges of bribery, extortion, and lying to the FBI. He's accused of trying to trade his vote for campaign contributions. Those indictments triggered a grassroots recall effort, which successfully got enough signatures to force a recall election, but it was a heavy lift. Caitlin Flynn is with us now. She managed the recall effort. Caitlin, what was the argument you made to get people to sign the recall petition?
Talking with folks, it wasn't hard to get them to sign. I mean, you know, he was indicted, like you said, for extortion, bribery, and lying to the FBI, and he missed over 100 votes to the legislature. And that's exactly what we said to people. And so most people, when they walked up to us, once we said, I'm with the Inman recall campaign, they were excited to sign. They took the pen out of our hands. But for folks who didn't know about it, that's all we said was, you know, he was indicted. He missed votes. We deserve representation. We deserve better. So will you sign the recall petition?
How many volunteers were out there on the streets getting signatures?
Over 150.
So how many signatures did you need to gather?
The minimum is 12,201 valid signatures.
And how many did you ultimately get?
Just under 14,000.
All right, so you topped the minimum. And there was once a time when citizens had 90 days to gather those petition signatures. But a quick history lesson, the recall law for legislators was changed during lame duck in late 2012. And reminder, that was a heck of a season. Right to work was jammed through. And then the Republicans pushed through major changes in the procedures for recalling elected officials. That 90-day window, that was shortened to 60 days. So, Caitlin, what did that shortened window of 60 days mean in your recall effort?
It made it a significant challenge. We had folks who were going out every single day for, you know, the last month or so to make sure that we hit our goals. And it wasn't only the 60-day window that made it a challenge. There's also a rule that they passed in that lame duck session in 2012 that you have to wait 6 months after the term is started of the state representative to start the recall process. So he was indicted in May, and we weren't able to start until July. And so what that did is that we had to start it all in July, you know, submitting the language for the petition, getting that approved. And then we had to wait another 40 days after Inman appealed our language. So we weren't able to start collecting petition signatures until September 23rd, which pushed us into really bad weather. We had to go through snowstorms, really, really difficult situations. And if we had been able to start in May, in June, it would have made the entire process a lot easier on our crew.
How did this effort compare to other campaigns you've done?
That's a good question. You know, I've worked on a lot of campaigns, and I would say this was the most challenging. The issue was something that everyone agreed upon. You know, he missed work and he was indicted. Those are bad. Right? We didn't have to convince people of that. But just the hoops that we had to jump through made it a difficult campaign.
Caitlin, do you know how many other recall efforts have succeeded since the law was changed in late 2012?
We are the first. We are the first campaign to have gotten this far since 2012. You know, when we dropped off the signatures to the State Board of Canvassers, they told us these are the first recall signatures we've seen since the laws were changed in 2012.
Caitlin, now that you've been through this process, what do you see as the legislature's purpose in changing the law or in 2012? Or what was the result of that change?
I believe that their purpose was to make it harder to recall our elected officials, and they certainly succeeded. They made it difficult for folks to hold their legislators accountable. You know, saying that we have to wait 6 months of their term, that's it. That's a year period where we are able to go through this process, you know, and it also has to only be for what they did during, like, in that term. So using our recall for an example, you know, we can recall him for, you know, being indicted and for missing work, but we cannot recall him, you know, for, you know, sending those text messages because it happened during his previous term.
So it certainly constricted things for you. What would you want to say
Absolutely.
To today's lawmakers, to the legislature today, as we're talking in 2019? What do you want to say to them about this recall law?
I would say that this law makes it difficult for voters to have a voice, and that the laws need to change because our elected officials need to be held accountable for their actions. You know, it shouldn't be so hard to recall someone who has done a lot of bad things. You know, at the bare minimum, not showing up to work at the state house for 3 months, missing over 100 votes, that's what we elected Representative Larry Inman to represent us, to be voting on the House floor, to be in committees, to, you know, caucus with his peers. And he, you know, he didn't vote for 3 months and he wasn't able to be in his caucus, or he was kicked out of his caucus. He doesn't have constituent services anymore. No staff, no office. It shouldn't be so hard to have representation.
Caitlin, at the bare minimum, what changes do you think need to be made in this law?
I think that the window should, you know, at least go back to 90 days. And I think that we should be able to recall them, you know, regardless of how far into their term they are.
And as for Representative Larry Inman, he has to make a decision early next week. What? Tell us about that.
Yes, so he has to decide by Monday if he would like to remain on the ballot for this recall election.
So he has to decide what, to opt out, or he is automatically the Republican nominee?
That's exactly right. If he chooses, he is automatically the Republican nominee. This triggers a normal, you know, a normal general election to decide who will be filling this seat. And so Monday is the day that he has to decide, you know, does he want to stay on the ballot and stay our representative, or is he going to opt out and let a different Republican take his place on the ballot?
Caitlin Flynn managed the recall campaign against State Representative Larry Inman successfully, turning in somewhere around 14,000 signatures in 60 days. Caitlin, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy. I was glad to be here.
A few weeks ago, we told you how cherry farmers in Michigan are suffering from the fallout of that international trade war. While they wait to see where the political cards fall, many farmers are bearing down for the winter. Here's Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston with an update.
After an early snowstorm in mid-November, Tom Coronado is staying warm in a tractor. He works for Cherry Key, a farming operation in Coaden. In between some tart cherry trees, a worker holds a 10 to 12 foot fence post in place. Then Coronado, in his tractor, plants what looks like a stamp down on top. The tractor shoves the post into the ground, loudly rattling along the way. Coronado plants about a dozen of these posts next to a line of young tart cherry trees. He does this work every year, along with other winter upkeep like pruning. When this fence is done, it will hopefully protect the young trees from deer.
If we don't do it, we battle the deer, so they'll prune the trees for us in a way we don't like.
And every cherry that farmers can keep this winter matters, especially now. The industry is not doing well. Michigan farmers have been getting priced out of the fruit market by cheap foreign competitors for years. Since 2006, the state has lost 160 tart cherry farms. And across the country, production is already down 18% from last year. That's all from the USDA. The industry recently got help via tariffs on Turkish cherry exporters, who were their biggest competitor. That has to have helped, right?
But how are things just broadly in northern Michigan cherries right now?
Well, they haven't changed a whole lot.
That's Nels Veliket, the head of Cherry Key and a member of the Dried Tart Cherry Trade Committee. He says importers have leftover cherries from Turkey. They're still selling those off instead of buying domestic ones.
So it's hard to know how long it will take for that inventory to work its way through the system before they begin buying domestic source cherries.
Veliket and other farmers told all of this to U.S. Senator Gary Peters at a meeting in Traverse City a few weeks ago. He said he'll take it back to Washington.
For them to understand, this is not just about cherry growers in Traverse City. It's about other small manufacturers and small industries across the country.
Earlier this year, Peters introduced a bill to make the U.S. Commerce Department investigate trade issues on behalf of small industries like cherries. That bill is stuck in committee. In fact, the whole Michigan cherry industry is kind of stuck in what Veliket describes as a holding pattern. One thing they've been waiting on are federal subsidies for lost profits from the trade war with China. The USDA is giving relief funds to farmers affected by that, but tart cherry farmers aren't on the list. Daniel Sumner is with the Agricultural Issues Center at the University of California, Davis. He says that subsidy program is super broad and doesn't get to a lot of farmers that may need it.
They're not painting with a brush, they're painting with a roller. You don't get the Mona Lisa done that way.
On top of that, Sumner says those subsidies are set to expire in November of 2020, and he says he's not sure if anyone will care about farmers after the election. In the meantime, Michigan farmers are tending to their cherry trees. The hope is they'll survive the winter, and they'll have a strong harvest next year. For Points North, I'm Max Johnston.
That story was featured on Points North, a weekly show and podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. You can find more episodes at pointsnorthradio.org. Coming up, more than 1.7 million Michiganders are expected to hit the road for the Thanksgiving holiday. We'll check in with a Michigan State Police trooper about the Michigan left and more do's and don'ts of the road. Stay with us. Thank you. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. With the holidays finally at hand, no doubt we'll be buying wine for festive dinners and lots of parties. So what is your go-to wine and where is it from? Michigan's winemakers are hoping that some of their bottles will be on your wine radar. Let's talk about the image of Michigan wines and explore whether they're getting enough respect. With us now is Gina Shea. She is a certified sommelier and the acting VP of the Michigan Wine Collaborative. It's a volunteer organization of about 180 industry members. And winemaker Lee Lutz is a managing member of Black Star Farms in Sutton's Bay and Old Mission Peninsula. Lee, I'm going to start with you. As a winemaker, what do you feel that people tend to get wrong about Michigan wine?
Well, Cindy, the answer is a long one, but generally the misconception is still that Michigan only makes sweet wines. It's a misconception that's been around a long time, and you know it stems from an awful lot of the history that really shaped the wine industry here in Michigan from early on. Much of that based in and around fruit that was grown for the juice industry and kind of crossed over into the wine industry a little bit. But of course, you know, in days gone by, wines that were sweet and stronger in their fermentation alcohol were often wines that were a little bit more stable and they lasted longer. So often those types of wines were made for the simple fact that they held on, they stuck around. But that's certainly not the case any longer.
You know, I'm thinking back, and my parents, they didn't drink or have a lot, but they would, upon occasion, I'm remembering bottles of cold duck.
yes.
And you're chuckling. Talk to us yes. about the history of cold duck in Michigan, and tell people who are not my age what cold duck is.
Well, cold duck is one of those things that if you're in the wine industry, it's almost a little bit of an embarrassment. Because A, it means you're old enough to remember it, and B, it was one of those things that I think was originated in Detroit, and it was a sparkling sweet beverage that seemed to be all the rage for a period of, I don't know, 10 years plus in the, probably the mid-70s. And it just seemed to be on everybody's table because it was easy to drink. But it was one of those things that you knew that if you had enjoyed a glass or two too many, you definitely were going to pay the price for it the next day.
Well, I think you could probably address California winemakers and say the words Boone's Farm apple wine, and they would also cringe from that
yes.
same era.
Most
we were
definitely.
Not wine sophisticates in the 60s and 70s.
No.
Gina Shea,
no.
You started your wine career in the Finger Lakes region of New York State, and then you came to Michigan. So I'm wondering, what were your impressions of Michigan wine before you came here?
I assumed it was going to be fairly similar because the climate is similar, the age of the wine regions is fairly similar, and I wasn't wrong. There are a lot of similarities between the two, which is great because right now New York is getting a lot of national and international recognition, and we are hoping to just copy a lot of their best practices. it's very similar. It's a cool climate winemaking region with many of the same grape varieties.
Which are what? Give us an idea of the kind of varieties that grow well in Michigan.
Well, you know, this is actually one of the myths that people seem to think about Michigan, that Michigan doesn't seem to do red wine or they can't grow red grapes. But some of the things that are grown not only here but in other cool climate regions around the Great Lakes would be Cabernet Franc. These are names that people would readily recognize. Merlot, Bordeaux blends that include Cabernet Sauvignon, Cab Franc, Merlot, Pinot Noir. There's a little bit of Syrah here and there in Michigan. And then some grapes that they may not be familiar with but that are grown in most cool climate regions.
And Lee, I should let you kind of jump in to kind of wipe out the taste of cold duck from our mouths as we
yes,
talk to you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Tell me, first of all, do you make a dry wine at Black Star Farms?
Actually, Cindy, we had a reputation early on in our business development of being a winery that really was creating more dry wine than sweet wine. And, you know, the issue here in the Midwest is that we still have a relatively sweet palate. There's still an awful lot of people that enjoy sweeter wines, and often that's because it's their first venture into wine. Usually as you start, you often may start a little bit sweeter and then move towards drier wines in time. And, you know, with the majority of the larger wine producing regions being on either coast, significantly on the West Coast, of course, you know, the Midwest is a region that's still exploring and finding wine, and especially finding wine in their own backyard. So we, by all means, make a lot of dry wine, but we still do make some wines that are a little bit on the sweeter side, balancing, you know, the higher acid that we tend to have in our cooler climate with a little bit of residual sugar that just helps make the wine easier to drink, for especially for people that are just really getting started with wine.
If you just joined us, we are talking about Michigan wines as we speak with Gina Shea, who is a sommelier and the acting VP of the Michigan Wine Collaborative, and Lee Lutz, who's a managing member of Black Star Farms in Suttons Bay and Old Mission Peninsula. Lee, is there much collaboration among the different Michigan wineries? I guess I'm wondering, how do you balance competing with working together for the greater good of Michigan wines?
Cindy, we have been doing this long enough that we have only ever seen benefits by having either formal partnerships or informal partnerships, doing an awful lot of collaborative work, an awful lot of joint marketing, an awful lot of work together to not only market but promote the general themes around Michigan wine. Our industry is really too small, even as a state, to think of our neighbors as competitors. We are really working together to just build what Gina was just talking about from the standpoint of more national and international recognition. I think we're a long way from needing to worry about, you know, the competition from down the street. And really, you know, we've got an awful lot of other work to do to just get us to the point where we can compete with the likes of, you know, the bigger wine producing states out west and certainly in Europe. An awful lot of it is in a region like this is driven by tourism. And so an awful lot of what we do is promote over our tasting bars and, you know, really work with people one-on-one when they come into our tasting rooms. And that's such a great way to do it. But at the same time, when people walk in and say, you know, I'm not really a fan of what I'm tasting here, where else might you suggest I try? It's easy to suggest wineries right down the road. Because whether you're in the Southwest or the Southeast or the Northwest, there's always wineries that are close by. And everybody's doing something a little bit different. And it's always easy to suggest someone else that may have something that you don't.
Gina, how many wineries are in Michigan? Since you are, there with the Michigan Wine Collaborative, what's the nose count?
Yes, we have about 150 commercial wineries in Michigan right now.
Okay. And what do you do with the Michigan Wine Collaborative? What's the mission?
The mission is to promote the Michigan wine industry as a whole and to do research and marketing that will help all of the wineries.
What kind of marketing strategies are you planning on to kind of boost the image and reputation of Michigan wines?
Well, the person who does most of our marketing work, Emily Dockery, who is our project and marketing coordinator for the Michigan Wine Collaborative, she is also a retail buyer for a local grocery chain, and she has the secret of hiding the Michigan wines among the other varieties. Rather than having a Michigan wine section, she will put the Michigan Merlot with the California and the French Merlot. She will put, and basically because in the United States, we tend to buy wines by variety instead of by region. Whereas in France, you buy Bordeaux. You're not necessarily seeking out a Cabernet Franc heavy blend. You're looking at a Bordeaux. And so she said in the United States, because we buy grapes by variety, it's better to put the Michigan grapes with the other grapes of the same variety so that people will find them there. Because if they do have a preconceived notion that Michigan only makes sweet wine, then when they went to the Syrah section looking for a Syrah, they'd be pretty excited and happy to find one that was local. Like, oh my gosh, I didn't know Michigan made Syrah. And here it is with the Syrah from the Rhone Valley and from California. We want to surprise and delight people and let them know that Michigan wine can hang with wine of similar quality from around the world.
With that in mind, what would both of you say, and I'll let you start with it, Gina, what is the reputation or the image of Michigan wine? And in particular, I'm wondering, is it different within Michigan versus other states? Now, do Michiganders tend to underestimate our own wines?
I think that's a very fair statement, and I think that happens in a lot of emerging regions. One of the things that one of our very astute members said the other day, and this was just a consumer member who I was having a conversation with, He said, no self-respecting wine region ever gained notoriety in its own backyard before another region recognized it. And I thought, that's so true, because so many times people either take it for granted or they don't keep up with what's happening in the industry. Because as Lee said, the Michigan wine industry had a reputation for only making sweet wines that had been converted kind of from grape juice growing grapes to over to wine without possibly as much thought or research as it would take to make very fine wines. But if someone lives in Michigan and hasn't visited a winery nearby them recently, they would probably be surprised to taste the quality of the wines. And the myth also, you know, we've got 150 wineries, so the myth that wine country is far away is also not true, because we've got 5 wine regions, 1 in the UP and 4 in the Lower Peninsula, and they are within 2 to 3 hours or less of everybody in the state. So there's always something nearby to go check out and taste to see if there's something that will please your palate. And there will be.
Lee, who do you find outside of Michigan has an appreciation for Michigan wines when you think of your customers?
Cindy, we do an awful lot of work with some of the larger cities nearby. Chicago is a big target for just about every wine producer in the state of Michigan that has wine to sell into some of those larger markets. But we also do an awful lot of work in Ohio, be it Toledo or Cincinnati, Cleveland. We do some work in New York. And often what we find in those cities outside of the state is that the sommeliers and the people that are working with consumers, either over the counter or within restaurants, they find our wines very refreshing because A, the wines tend to be very bright. We retain an awful lot of acidity in the fruit that we work with, and the wines have tremendous table presence. They pair really well with food, and they just hold on to a freshness that is starting to, I don't want to say fade out entirely, but it's as some of the warmer regions are becoming warmer, some of that freshness is being lost. It's almost as if the freshness is being warmed right out of the fruit. And so in a climate like ours, that's still retaining all the parameters of a good, cool climate region, our fruit and our wines have a freshness to them that's not common in most bottles that you may open of comparable varieties.
Now, that's an interesting point. So climate change is leaving its mark when you think of the output in this country.
Climate change is definitely leaving its mark. And it's something that all regions around the world are really starting to address via needing to change grape varieties that they're growing, the winemakers in those regions needing to make adjustments in the winemaking techniques and the styles of wine that they're making. But it's part of the benefit that we have here in Michigan is that we're still so far north. And as a mid-continental region, we're somewhat protected from some of the larger issues of climate change, at least for the time being. The only reason we can really do what we're doing here in Michigan is because of the Great Lakes. There's really not another grape-growing region as far north as we are that's growing comparable varieties between, you know, Albany, New York, and Spokane, Washington. I mean, it's really kind of an anomaly that a region like ours, as far north as we are, can grow some of these key varieties. So it's a pretty special place.
You know, Gina, we have been talking all year, really, since the spring right through till the big snowstorm we had in early November. Growers and farmers in Michigan have had a rotten year. We've talked to people that grow corn, people that grow apples. That cold, wet spring and that early November snowstorm, 1-2 punch. How have the Michigan wineries that you work with weathered this year?
Well, they took a hit, like you said. Most of my clients in the Northwest are doing okay. They seem to have, they said it was not the most outstanding vintage they've ever seen, but it's going to be a good vintage, and they're outstanding winemakers, so it's going to be fine. The guys in the Southwest had a rough time. In January, there was a significant cold snap, a mini polar vortex, I guess, and they lost a lot of their early buds. Their crop was going to be much, much smaller. So many of them had to rely on other growers within the state. They had to call on friends who had excess grapes and try to purchase some. Some of them have enough inventory that they were just going to release fewer wines this year. Unfortunately, in Michigan, this is not something that we're a stranger to. It's happened before. And several of my customers in our Michigan Wine Collaborative industry members have started to hedge their bets by offering consumers other things, such as cider. So they're relying on apples instead of grapes, or their apples are their plan B. Or they have introduced a brewery on site as well to help appeal not only to a wider customer base, but also to hedge their bets against Mother Nature.
Talk to the people who are going to be going shopping for their Thanksgiving dinners, for the parties coming up, who automatically, reach for a California or reach for wine from France or Australia. Give us the elevator pitch. Why think Michigan wines, Lee?
Well, Cindy, what I've been saying to people is there is no better time than right now to either discover or further enhance your familiarity with Michigan wines. There are some fabulous wines from the last couple of vintages that are out there right now. The 2017 vintage left us with some incredible whites and incredible reds. An awful lot of those are either just hitting the market or are in the market, for sale at your local wine shop right now. The wineries that are releasing some of the wines from 2018, those wines as well are drinking beautifully and retain an awful lot of the classic characteristics of those varieties that we grow. For the holidays, I'm one who is always advocating that we eat local and drink local. Michigan is such a great locavore state, and there's so much good local cuisine that's grown nearby, regardless of where you live, that what better reason to pair local wine with great local food than the fact that you get that synergy on the palate of all things local and support the Michigan economy and, hopefully have an experience at the table that's hard to beat.
Gina Shea, what's going to be the star bottle on your Thanksgiving table?
Well, there's more than one.
Good.
We tend not to get crazy and limit ourselves on Thanksgiving, since it's one of the big feast days every year. The great thing about Thanksgiving table is that the traditional American foods, there are so many flavors on the table that you really can't go wrong with what you pair. So for Michigan wine, I'm going to certainly have some Riesling. We have 3,000 acres of wine grapes planted in this state, and 700 of them are Riesling. And so we know Riesling. We do it well in both dry and sweet. So I will have a couple Rieslings on my table, at least one Michigan Pinot Noir. I'm a huge Pinot fan, and we do a great job here, as well as Cab Franc. And the pièce de résistance is always Michigan sparkling wine. And that's something that I don't know if people realize how many of our wineries do beautiful sparkling wines. And sparkling wine goes with everything. So it's if you only have one bottle on your Thanksgiving table, you could find a Michigan sparkling wine that will work with every single thing on the table.
Well, it sounds wonderful. And we want to thank both of you for kind of sharing your love of wine and your mission to bring Michigan wines to the forefront. Lee Lutz, Black Star Farms in Sutton's Bay and Old Mission Peninsula, and Gina Shea with the Michigan Wine Collaborative. Happy Thanksgiving, and thank you for being with us.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks, Cindy.
Cindy, thank you very much for your interest. Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening. And from all of us at Stateside, have a very, very happy Thanksgiving.